Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
If it wasn't for your strength, I'd be stuck. If it wasn't for your love, I'd give up. And your peace says enough. Grab me up, soak my bones in it. Can see the enemy creeping through the bushes. Come on and get it. Can feel you covering me, pulling on me, loving on me, standing with me. You hold the water when my heart is feeling dry and empty. So let the haters talk, I'm deaf to what it is they say. Know you with me night and day, command and I will obey.
I can curse
out. Yeah, Russell.
Yeah, Russell. You deny.
I'll be sure to tell you.
Sufficient way to say, oh Lord, that you are my everything. Pray that my life shall sing of the glory you unselfishly display. I can tell you how I feel about you. I love you,
to you in hot pursuit, dressed in parachutes, willing to jump from planes, no matter the route. I have flown the commute, just as long as we together forever, no matter whatever. I never wanna part from you, cause apart from you, I ain't nothing, ain't no future in my fucking, and you know it is true, yeah.
Yes, it's a glorious day in spring, and I can't believe how the time has flown. We are deep in May right now, and you just heard 12 Russell Delegation, How I Feel About You, featuring B. Wells, Lisa McClendon, Tia Pittman, and Mahogany Jones. And I picked this spiritually rich tune to open today's segment because of its touching overtones, lifting up the Most High. Now, before soaring into today's broadcast, here's a little touch of grace. I will never fly solo, not with the unyielding power of faith and love from you. You are in every breath I take, in every step that I take. You are in the four seasons and in the sudden breeze that races around me. You inspire me to smile whenever the blues fills me up. You are a refreshing newness in the overflowing cup. Because of you, I have all that I need in this life. You are the whole, the full, and the everything that's right. I'll never fly solo because shining within is your essence of life. People of the world, I'm your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Friday, the 9th of May, and today and the time is 1:30 p.m. Success looks like collaboration, inclusiveness, and creativity. These words of action are powerful breadcrumbs that have been scattered along life's path by today's guest to bridge the gap between past generations and the new generation, focusing on seven key questions. Bigger Than Hip-Hop is a book that provides readers with a deeper insight into the needs and mindsets of young adults in today's culture. Ron Bell Jr. served as one of the founders and lead pastors of Arise Church. His divine passion is to help people uncover their destiny so they can find and renew their relationship with Jesus Christ. He is committed to three things: empowerment, helping others, and the practical teachings of the Word of God. He is a creative soul with branches in music and a nationally recognized New Church Start consultant, as well as a coach. His company, Bell Bowties, also gives him the title of entrepreneur. He has also served as director of congregational development and SBC 21 for the Peninsula Delaware United Methodist Conference. He has completed his doctorate in theology, DM from Lancaster Theological Seminary. He also has a master's in theology, MA, from Regent University, and a bachelor's in philosophy, which is a BA from Morgan State University. And he joins me today here on iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. So without further ado, the man of the hour, welcome to the show, Ronald. How are you doing today?
Well, listen, I was doing good to start, but your introduction just put me over the top. Scattered pieces on the road to, I'm like, oh God, that is nice. You will have to introduce me more often. That is nice.
Well, I am so glad you liked it. I tell you, it just comes from God. I mean, I'll sit down to write these shows, Ronald, and I just start writing the words and they just come. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. But I'm even
you,
more
you have
so,
a way with words. You do. You do.
Well, thank you so much, and God, now you got me blushing in here. So I just want to welcome you to the show. I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about your inspiring book, Bigger Than Hip-Hop, and I believe that it is definitely overdue, and we can always use the positivity that you're bringing into the world. So you are quite an accomplished individual. The intro is because it's all you. So how did the earlier years How did the earlier years shape the man that you have become today?
You know, it's funny you would start there, and I'll explain why I appreciate your ability to use words. I grew up and from a very young age had a severe stuttering problem. I mean, like, to the point where I couldn't speak. You know, if I try to get a word out, you know, it would just either come out stammered or it just wouldn't come out at all. And so, you know, I've just always appreciated words and just the ability of anybody to be able to get something out. Because for me, just to get out a word has always been a struggle. You know, we went through speech therapists, we went through all kinds of programs, we went through all kinds of psychologists at a young age, you know, and just kind of really worked through it. But I know what a privilege it is to be able to be heard. And I think a lot of my journey has been around helping others be heard in whatever form that is. So whatever your dream or passion it is, how do I help you be heard? How do I help you get your language out? How do I help you get your words in front of people? You know, your passion. And to me, you know, again, because I know at any minute, look, even during this interview, I may just start stuttering and going crazy. Any minute, you know, it is not promised that I can be that I can speak. And so it is a privilege. And so to me, man, I my whole life has been about seeing that come to fruition with other people in any sort of manner. So whether it's teaching, whether it's counseling, whether it's coaching, whether it's, you know, working with congregations, I just want to see people develop in whatever God has put inside of them.
Yeah, well, one thing that I can honestly say about you, and I've got chill bumps all over, such an inspiration, that you stepped forward with courage and put yourself in a position of where you would be forced and are forced to talk in front of people, especially being a minister, and then also, too, with the work that you're doing with our youth. So just out of curiosity, where does stuttering come from?
Where does the act of stuttering come from, or why do I stutter?
Yeah, because I knew a young man when I was growing up who stuttered too, and as he got older, I guess he went to speech class and he didn't do it as often. So did, in your findings, going to the places where you went to actually get help for it, did you find out where it originates from within the mind?
No, I think they're still messing with that science. I can tell you that I hated every single moment of my speech therapy session. I hated it. I just felt like they were trying to remake me. You know, mm-hmm. I stutter. It's a part of who I am. I'm cool with that. You know, just give me a couple mm-hmm. minutes and the word will come out eventually. You know, don't try to remake me. You know, but I think that at least for me, I'm just high energy and I have a lot of thoughts going on at once. And so they're all just trying to get on the same train. You know, so sometimes, you know, a couple get on, sometimes more get on, sometimes less get on. You know, so I think for each of us it's different. There was a movie that came out called The King's Speech 3 or 4 years ago, and they tried to link stuttering to some kind of traumatic event that happened somewhere in your youth, and because of the event, you stopped speaking, and that created a stutter. I'm not sure that's true. So depending on where you go, you talk to, you know, some will say it's rhythm, some will say it's some kind of disconnect between the mechanics of speech and of thinking. You know, so it just depends on who you ask. But I just think it's individual. So, you know.
Yeah, and I like how you explained it because it definitely does make sense. You know, your energy level is like at I don't know how many knots. So, you know, like you said, a lot of words will climb on at the same time because they just want to get out. And, you know, I honestly just feel that it's just the blessing. You are just bursting with so much inspiration and insight that, you know, the words sometimes want to come all out at the same time. But you're doing fantastic today. So I thank you for that courage and being that courage. So now, where did you grow up and where do you reside now?
I grew up on the lower eastern shore of Maryland. My father was a pastor, still is pastoring on the lower eastern shore of Maryland. So in the country, way, way, way country, you know, near the border of Virginia. But now, as an adult, I live in Wilmington, Delaware, which is probably closer to Philly than the lower shore, about 30 minutes from my Philly now.
And so let's talk about this wonderful calling that you received. At what age did you receive the calling, and how did it come to you?
Oh, it was a struggle. I'm sure if you ask, you know, some other pastors, they'd be honest too. I had no intention, no desire to be a pastor. No. Listen, I went to undergrad. First of all, I went to undergrad on a music scholarship. I was a musician. I played saxophone and was really good. Got a full scholarship at Morgan State University. Went to Morgan State, started playing a bunch of different jazz bands and different places around the city, you know, D.C. and Baltimore. What I wasn't doing was going to band rehearsal. At the end of my freshman year was carjacked on Edmondson Avenue. Guy took my car, took my saxophone. I had nothing left. Went to the band director afterwards, said, "Hey, man, can you help me out?" He says, "No, not only is he not giving me a new instrument, but he took my scholarship." And so there at the end of freshman year, I had to decide, okay, well, who am I and what am I outside of music? And so I settled into philosophy. ended up graduating with a degree in philosophy. Because to me, you know, philosophy, man, is just like jazz. It's the same thing. You know, it's just mm-hmm. instead of using music, it's just using thought and words. So it worked for me. So I graduated with a degree in philosophy. But as you know, there is no job ever anywhere in the world for a person with a bachelor's degree in philosophy. And so a friend of mine dared me to go to take the LSAT for a law school. And so I took them and did really well and ended up getting into law school in Michigan. And I was there for 2 years, and it was just crazy. And on break my second year, I went home to visit my parents on the Lower Eastern Shore of Maryland. And one of my father's friends, who's also a pastor, you know, said to me, you know, perhaps law school is your whale. Perhaps you found yourself like Jonah, where you're really running from something God is trying to say. And I never really thought critically about it. I thought, you know, I'm supposed to be a musician. That didn't work out. Okay, now I'll be a lawyer. You know, so it was never a thought, you know, I'm saying no to theology or saying no to God. It just was I never tried to listen to hear what God might be saying. You know, it's a whole different thing when we ask God, what are you saying? Versus ignoring. You know what I mean? And so I'm there in law school saying, okay, God, what are you saying? And clearly heard the voice of God say preach. I'm like, that ain't what I want to do. I was hoping you would say something else.
Well, you know what? You said some pretty cool things here as far as faith and understanding of when adversities hit us in life and how we emerge, because it's all about how we emerge from it. So when I looked at the video that I saw on your website, sawed-off shotgun in your side, you were robbed. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment with that person, did you get a chance to look into that person's eyes? And if you did, what did you see in those eyes that affected you and changed your life?
Oh, listen, brother, not only did I look into his eyes, this man helped me wash my car.
Huh?
Yeah. We were at the car wash, and I saw him standing there by himself, and I said, hey, man, do you want to help me wash the car? You know, put some of my money in your pocket. So he helped me wash my car. I paid him. Then he robbed me. Yeah. So I looked in his eyes. I got his whole story, life story and mother and, you know, how he was down on his luck and just trying to get by. And so I helped him out. Then he robbed me. But the look in his eyes said to me, I'm hungry.
Oh.
There's no other way to describe it. It was a look of hunger, a look of scarcity, a look of starvation, you know, and so, you know, that's where, and I have to be careful here, because you know, there are always two things working, you know, there is mm-hmm. the physical, but we wrestle not, you know, against physical, you know, these are principalities of spirits, you know, and sometimes we attribute to the enemy things that don't really reside with him, that don't mm-hmm. belong to him. Sometimes God sets stuff up so we can change course and see him clearly. Let me be very honest with you. If I had stayed mm-hmm. a musician, I would not be a pastor.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Okay. And so I don't want to attribute that this was the devil. Oh, the devil did it and he got. No. God said it's time to change direction. So here's a young man who could benefit.
Mm-hmm. And so the look in his eyes said, I'm hungry. And so do you believe that hunger was for food or was it for spiritual enlightenment?
I don't know. I would, you know, at this level, I would say spiritual enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Back then, I would probably say food or some kind of substance or something,
mm-hmm.
something tangible that he would, you know, consume and, you know, be done with. But mm-hmm. but again, I think more so than that, I just think it was a God moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I'm very honest about who I was at that moment, I don't know that I would be here now if he had not robbed me. And that sounds crazy. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds crazy, but I know what I was into. I know what I was doing. I know where I was heading. I know how many I was messing with. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I just don't think I would have made it here the way I am here now if that situation had never happened. And so I have to give God praise for that. I have to.
Well, you know what? I hear God all in that particular incident and how you emerge or how we emerge from adverse things like that. Because, you know, you said you lost your saxophone, you lost your car, you probably lost a little bit of your confidence in that situation because I'm pretty sure, you know, that situation that presented itself, you never saw coming. And so I think what it tells me is that we could go out there going to McDonald's or going to KFC or wherever, and we might encounter the same thing. How would we actually deal with that? And I'll share something with you. There's a Chevron station that's over by near a place called the Dumbarton Bridge. And so I was riding through, and I was about to turn to enter traffic, and this Mexican guy cut me off. And so I raised up my hand, and the guy looked at me, and I could tell in his eyes that he was going to shoot me if I didn't say the right word. And so what I said was, oh, man, I thought you worked at IKEA, because at that time I was working at IKEA. And he looked at me and he goes, hell no, man, I don't work at no IKEA. And he took off. But what I saw in his eyes was rage. There was just pure, unadulterated rage in his eyes, and he looked like he was probably high. So, you know, very lucky are we that we have encountered incidents like this and made the right choices as opposed to allowing our masculinity and our vibrato to get in front of it because, you know, we could be dead. So let's talk about life because you said that, you know, you dabbled in a little bit of everything. So when you look back on life when you were young versus what you see today, what are some of the differences you see for the better and for the worse?
For the better for myself or the world?
It could be in two parts, however you choose to answer the question.
Okay, okay. Let me just go back real quick and say this, though, that for your situation, for mine as well, I think either we believe the scripture or we don't. See, I believe Romans when it says all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord and call for his purpose. I believe that. I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless if something goes, stays, comes, whatever, I am believing that it is a part of what God is doing. It may not feel good. It may not look right. It may not taste good. You know. But it is a part of what God is doing in my life. And so I, if you were to say, what do you hold on to scripturally? I hold on to that. I hold on to all things work together. I have to believe that. Without that, I'd have no faith. I'd have no hope. You know, I'd go crazy. I'd be him. Without that, I would be him. I'd be the one robbing somebody for a car in the set. You know, I'd be him. And so, I have to believe that for my life. What do I see positive and different? Having grown. You know, when I was younger, I think I had a bit of that Superman complex and thinking, you know, it's all about me and you know, I can make it happen and I can do it. You know, but life will offer you up a plate of failures, you know, and some real stuff that will humble you fast. Mm-hmm. That will make you define your character. You know, when I was young, you know, anything went, you know, as far as a character, as far as you know, ethics, you know. But as a grown man, you know, now with the son, and you know, and who ministers to children, and you know, who sees these young girls, you know, I'm ashamed of some of the stuff I did. I'll be very honest. I'm ashamed. Mm-hmm. You know, I sat in a room 3 weeks ago. They had a major event in Wilmington, and they asked me to come and be a part of a panel. And there were 300 young girls there. And we were talking to them about what it means to be a man and how, you know, what marriage looks like and what men are looking for. And I'm looking at these 300 young women. And, you know, and I'm honored to be able to be there and to sow into their lives and to pray over them and to give them sound wisdom and advice, both biblical and natural, about you know, what it means to be a man, what it means to be, you know, a king. But the reality is, if you had caught me 10 years ago, you wouldn't have asked me to be in that room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thank God for maturity and growth. I thank God for forgiveness. I thank God that you know, he washes me and has redeemed me. Because certainly, man, I was not qualified. And so those are the places where I see hope, in myself specifically. In the world, I am encouraged by our coming generation. I am encouraged. I know that there's a lot of people who think that, you know, we're getting worse and, you know, they crime and, you know, but I see some young people, man, some young adults with new ideas and passion. I see some young people who are just bursting with, you know, a love of Christ and out-the-box thinking and different ways of just communicating and being. And to me, that gives me hope. You know, uh-huh. You know, when I see kids breakdancing or using art to express themselves theologically or using their own body, you know, hair color, whatever else, you know, just to express themselves, to me, I'm like, okay, we got a chance. There's so much good that I think we waste a lot of our prayer time and energy on what's missing and what's bad. We just need to be grateful and just let God be God. Because all of it, man, again, all of it is working together. But there is so much, specifically when it comes to our young people and young adults. They have ideas that just astound me weekly astound me.
You know, what's interesting, I think back on when you talk about artistic expression, and an escape, I think that art plays such an important role in our society as a whole. Now, if you take the group, NWA, which was the acronym for Niggas with an Attitude, so you had mm-hmm. Ice Cube, who is now gone on to become a multimillionaire, making very family-friendly films. And just today I heard that Dr. Dre, who was also a part of that group, Apple is actually getting ready to purchase a lot of his beats. So he is for $3.5 billion. So
billion.
When we talk about,
billion.
Yeah, billion. So when we talk about, you know, being encouraged by the coming generation, you know, society would like you to believe that we are all gangbangers, we are all drug heads. But, you know, there are really some positive African-American people who came from the streets, your Jay-Z's and, you know, these people who have gone on to become entrepreneurs, and they are actually giving back. And so I believe that when we're ashamed of our past dwellings, that means that that's hope right there. So
yeah.
Let's
yeah.
talk about the alarming statistics pertaining to the prison population, where Black men are the largest percentage of inmates. And so what are your thoughts about that disturbing reality? Because, yeah, there are a lot of good things that are going on, but then we still have this damn, you know, institutionalized slavery of people
yeah.
of color. You know, what are your thoughts about that? And have you ventured into the penal system to actually spread the word that you have?
Actually, I have two ways of approaching that. One, I'll say that when I was in high school, I was a gavel away from being in prison myself, like one gavel away. You know, this dude was like, listen, if you show up here one more time, you know, it's over for you. I was on probation. I had been expelled from school, you know, been through the whole suspension process, one gavel away. God said, if you do one more thing, you know, your life will be, you know, in prison. But when I was in seminary at Regent University, I spent 4 years working in prison. And so my whole time when I was in seminary, I worked for two companies that specifically held young kids. And the kids had either, you know, killed somebody or raped somebody or, you know, had done some crazy sexual thing. And they all had, you know, mental stuff. And so it was, you know, the dual diagnosis. And so, you know, in addition to killing somebody, you know, they were bipolar, or in addition to raping, you know, their brother or something like that. You know, they had some other kind of, you know, schizophrenia or something. And so I mm-hmm. worked for four years in Virginia with that population while I was in seminary. I actually ran the worst youth on the plate. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, what's missing on a very practical level, these kids are not getting an education
right.
when it comes to our school. Like, it just isn't missing. So they can't read. They can't write. And, you know, that's okay when you're two, but when you're 17 and speak four, you should know how to read and write.
Right.
You know, because if you don't, it's gonna change how you communicate. Because now you can communicate in a way that's acceptable. Now you start communicating, you know, via, you know, your hands or some other form. So there's the educational piece. Then you have, and let's be very honest, have the physical addiction. And so
exactly.
If I grew up in a place where everybody was getting high or drinking, you know, then it tastes good to me. It feels good to me. And so for you to take that away or to tell me to stop, you know, over some character thing, okay, cool, but, you know, what are you going to do about the fact that my body has now been re-engineered to want this chemical?
Uh-huh.
And so we have a lot of young kids who chemically are just, you know, already drawn to heroin, chemically are drawn to, you know, cocaine or crack or whatever. And so, you know, mm-hmm. so there has to be something there that deals with that. And I saw that a lot. But and here's the problem. What we do as a system is we now replace heroin with some other medically prescribed pill. And so
right.
Now instead of being the heroin, now these kids are all strung out on, you know, the oxycodone or whatever the latest in-house, you know, drug is in prison. You want to know what the biggest industry is. It isn't the prison industrial complex. It's the healthcare system.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
They are getting rich off the prisons. They're getting rich off the state. You know how many prisoners are on drugs legally? Are taking four
mm-hmm.
or five pills a day? Like no, that's the system that's really getting the money. Now the educational system is getting screwed. But the healthcare system, the industrial complex, that's where the money is going because these kids, I'm telling you, I saw it. They're zombies. They're straight zombies. They can't read or write. You know, they're so hooked up on drugs that they can't feel pain. And so they act out and respond out of that. And so if you're going to make any difference, man, then we got to be honest about who the real devil is now. And I don't think, as a nation, we've been willing to do that.
No, not really. And couple hours ago, President Obama was here in where I live. I live near a city called Mountain View, and he was at a Walmart speaking. And just the other week, I was actually going to my mailbox in Mountain View, and what was on the corner were these women. They were white women. I have to call it like it was. And they had this booth set up outside of United States Post Office talking about getting rid of Obama because of his World War III, you know, doomsday type of situation. And so I got a chance to see some of the feedback about him being in Walmart, and people were, you know, being negative there about him. I think that as a president of the United States, especially an African-American one, he has faced so much underhanded and undermined activities that it is really ridiculous. So here we are. We have these young African-American men who are, like you said, mentally droid. And, you know, connected to that is a soul or caring about, you know, raping or doing all of these thoughts. You know, they're mentally incapable, and then they do the ultimate thing that lands them, like you said, one gavel away from being in prison. So here they are, even with an African-American president, you know, we still have so many obstacles that we are facing right now. But there is a lot of good that I believe needs to be promoted, which is why I'm glad I'm doing this show with you, Ronald Bell, today in your book, The Bigger Bigger Than Hip Hop. I think that it is definitely needed, and I am encouraged to actually write something that is going to add something better to the mind state. But, you know, reaching those kids is another thing, and that's what we're talking about with your book, being able to actually reach these people here in the hip hop generation. So how did you come up with the name, and what drove your decision? I think we probably answered that question, but what drove your decision to write this particular book?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. What happened was part of my position prior to becoming a full-time pastor, and I just did that last year. So for the last 4 years, I've been basically a consultant for the United Methodist Church, and my role was to meet with different churches and congregations and help them start new ministries. Well, at one particular workshop, I was doing a national workshop about 3 years ago on young adults. And they asked me to bring some stats and talk about what's really going on. And so what I did, I interviewed 25 young adults from around the country, and I asked them these seven questions. You know, what are you seeing? What are you hearing? What do you want? What's missing? And I compiled their answers, and I shared their answers at this conference. Well, out of that, I continued with the study. So continue just, you know, pressing young adults. What, you know, what are you missing? What's being said? You know, what's it going to take to get you, you know, to get you in? How do you see Jesus? What's going on? Because, again, the thing is that this is a book about what young adults are saying about young adults. So this is not some, you know, statistician at Harvard who said, you know, in 1936 there were the stats. No, this is what the guy on the corner is saying about what it would take him to come into your church. This is what he's saying about what's going on in his household from his lips. And so we used what we heard from them at Arise at our new church start for a year to see if it worked in practice. And so for a year we used some of the principles they had given us. And what we found was in the year, you know, we planted the church in 2012. So we planted with eight people. What we found was that in a year, by using what they gave us, we grew from eight people to almost, well, really over 200 a week in worship. And so we talk about that growth in the book and give principles how we did it, what happened, what they said, how we applied, you know, their thoughts and how we saw stuff happen. And so the book lays out for you if you want your ministry to grow. If you want your church to grow, if you want your circle of influence to grow when it comes to young adults, here are the kinds of things that they're saying. Here's what they need, and here's how you can make that happen in your own context. And so the book really comes out of that framework. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into some of the points in the book, and I have some questions of my own that I'd like to ask you as well. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into a quick music break, and it's going to give us both a chance to readjust and then go ahead and complete the interview. So you mind sitting back for just a minute so we can hear a song?
No, sure.
All right, sounds great. Okay, so everybody listening today, I am talking to minister and author of the book Bigger Than Hip Hop. And right now we're going to get into a quick music break, and this is Kirk Franklin and Revolution. Take a listen, enjoy.
Book of Revelation, chapter 7, verses 16 and 17.
Yes, sir.
They shall hunger no more, neither shall they thirst anymore.
Preacher.
For God shall wipe away,
yes, sir,
every tear from their eyes.
Yes, sir.
Get ready for the revolution.
Come on.
What you say?
Come on.
Judge me, they
try to shame me, they try to buzz me, but they can't break me, cause I'm down with Christ. Dog child of new nation, and we're still alright. Well, alright.
Revolution, and we are having an intriguing discussion with a minister and author of the book Bigger Than Hip Hop. His name is Ronald Bell. And so, Ronald, I played Revolution because I thought it was so appropriate, especially for the topic of discussion today. Not that I want people to go busting up windows and, you know, burning up things, but there definitely needs to be some type of revolution here to reach our youth. So in your own words, can you describe the hip-hop generation and really what it stands for?
Sure. The hip-hop generation are those who were born between the ages of 1975 and 1995, so the 18 to 40-year-olds. And the reason why they call it the hip-hop generation is because, as you very well know, in 1980, hip-hop kind of burst onto the scene. And so hip-hop was a cultural shift from anything that America specifically had been used to. And so with hip-hop came all this opportunity to kind of recreate yourself, rebrand yourself, to be creative in how you express yourself, to go after your own kind of destiny, to use art, to use your own self, you know, as a muse to really reshape society. Now, out of that we had rap, out of that we had R&B, out of that we had so many other venues, but hip-hop itself as a grouping is suggest those people, those 18 to 40-year-olds who just said, you know what, I'm going to go do my own thing, and I'm going to do it fabulously. You know, I'm gonna go after it. It's going to be creative. It's going to be my own thing, and that's going to get me to where I'm at. And so you see now in 2014 some of the fruit of that. You just mentioned earlier Dr. Dre. Well, that's hip-hop. That's hip-hop. That's right. I can turn three of my friends in the middle of a gang to now $3-something billion. That's hip-hop
right.
mindset. You know, right. P. Diddy, hip-hop mindset. Jay-Z, hip-hop mindset. And so again, it's how do we take what God has naturally given us and make that thing work for us? And it was a whole generation that kind of fit into this thing.
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking when hip-hop first came on, the late, great Don Cornelius, he really didn't understand it, and he, Curtis Blow was cited as saying that he was really disappointed, or Russell Simmons was really disappointed in Don Cornelius saying that he didn't get it or he didn't understand it. And where I have to say, you know, there's a lot of the music, we were talking a little earlier before the show, there's a lot of music that really kind of, I don't know, it's so suggestive, and there's always been this thing about how African-American women or women in general are depicted in hip-hop, but that's just only one part of hip-hop. So let's talk about the main topics during the ministry conferences you attend and how prepared is the church to reach these individuals that are part of the hip-hop generation?
Sure, sure, sure. Well, let me just add here, though, that what we're seeing today, I would not classify as hip-hop. If you were to turn on 106 and Park tonight, I don't think that's hip-hop anymore. I think that's commercialized rap. I think that's a package you've been given, you know, to sell you a product. When I speak of KRS-One, I speak of people who were groundbreaking, people who created a whole new formula, people who set stuff into being that had not been there before. And so out of that came more than just lyrics. Out of that came industry. Out of that came businesses. Out of that came, you know, opportunities for others. You know, I think of LRE, Reed and different kind of you know models there. But so when I talk about hip hop, I'm talking about something more than just the rap you hear tomorrow night or tonight on the ride home. You know, to me that's something different. That's commercial. That's manufactured. That's fast food. I'm talking about a real good meal. This is grandma's meal. You know that's hip hop. That's hip-hop.
Yeah, more so. The hip-hop did used to be more socially conscious. And so go ahead. What were you about to say?
So as far as where the church is, the church in many ways is in trouble but has the greatest potential to have the best access. I think if the church kind of gets on board, I think that the church will be okay. The governing scripture for me is in 1 Samuel 17, and that's the story of when David fights Goliath. And I love that story because what happens is David shows up on the battlefield, and all of the children of Israel had been standing there in silence for almost 40 days, scared to death because of Goliath, you know. And so David shows up, and David says, "Why are you all scared? Like, we serve God, and he's just a man, you know, so we can go out and defeat him. But you got to do a couple things." The first thing David does is David speaks up, and then he steps forward. And when he steps forward, he finds the rock, and then he finds the rock, and he goes after Goliath. The problem for me, I think, when it comes to addressing the situation, is that the church has just been they've just been standing still. They've been stagnant. And so the world has provided so many different opportunities, so many other Goliaths that the church has no answer for. And so again, when I'm looking at the hip-hop generation, I'm looking at these folk who are coming up today, I'm looking at some Davids who don't mind stepping forward, who don't mind finding their rocks, finding, you know, that one thing they're good at, those two things they're good at, and using that to go after the world systems. The church is missing that boldness. It's missing that boldness. You know, and if we're going to engage young adults, we have got to be bold. We have got to step forward. We've got to be brilliant. We have to, you know, get rid of some of this old stuff. One of the chapters in the book is called Imaging. And I talk about in the chapter on imaging that, you know, anywhere else in the world, and you've already done this, on your radio station right now, you have already played two Grammy Award-winning artists. Right?
Right.
And so that's the natural, right? And you'll go home tonight and you'll turn on the TV and there will be an Oscar award-winning actor to act on TV. You know, and that's natural for you. But if you show up in the church, you know, they're struggling to get the song out. You know, they can't find the program. They're off key. This is off. This doesn't work. And so it's like, you know, if we're going to model something, then we have to model excellence, because in every other form, you know, the world sees excellence except when it comes to some of our churches. And if you want to attract young adults, there has to be excellence. Like, it doesn't work to have that old piano with half the keys out of tune. You need some updated stuff if you're going to attract young adults. In a chapter on support, I talk about relevance. You know. Let's just be real about some stuff. Young women have babies. Get over it. You know. If you really want young adults in your church, then start making some room for them. You know, go get a nursery. Go get some daycare workers. Put them at church so that they can get a break when they come to worship. Don't expect, you know, this 2-year-old and 3-year-old to sit quietly in the front pew. It ain't gonna happen. And so if we're going to make an impact, in young adults' lives, there has to be some relevance. And again, you know, the church has some ways to go. It can get there. It can get there, but it's got some ways to go.
Yeah, it really does. I was looking at, I mentor a young actor who was in the film Finding Forrester. And, of course, Finding Forrester was about an urban kid who encounters his teacher that is a recluse, and he's a white guy played by Sean Connery. And so this young talent that I mentor hit me onto the TED concept. I'm not sure if you've even heard it. TED is pretty popular. If you go on YouTube, you can hear it. But there's this woman. Her name was Bree. I can't remember her last name. But she said, you know, it's how we arm our children in the beginning that really makes it happen. Because when you're talking about love, if you ask somebody, what is your concept on love, they might talk about heartbreak as opposed to God's love, you know, because we are become so conditioned for the negative. And so if we put the positive affirmation into them when they're younger, for example, you know, check this out. You're an African-American girl or boy, but let me just tell you, you're going to face a lot of adversity. But you know what? It's normal in the life that you live, but you are going to be okay. You know, you can talk to me about anything as opposed to reacting to something that they've done in school, and then it just has this whole negative circle in them that they're getting attention because they're acting up in school. So there's a lot of truth to what you say. So let's talk about how this book was composed. You actually chose 25 young adults to interview, like you said. What were some of their insights on the ministry in today's culture?
You know, it was heartbreaking at times, profound at times. I just felt so humbled at times. They got real with me, and it just I just felt humbled to be in the conversation. We had one question, what are you missing in church that the world offers? And one of the answers, and you just said it, was love. We had a guy who said, you know, he's a youth pastor in New York City, major church. He does the choir, he does the youth, all of that. Well, this was 2 years ago now, was diagnosed full blown AIDS, and so he says that when he went to his pastor and told him, hey man, I got full blown AIDS. The first question wasn't how can we help you, what can we do for you. The first question was, are you gay? And so he says, you know, what's missing is that love. We have a girl who in the book talks, you know, we asked her, what can the church offer? And she says, you know, different opportunities. You know, she goes to a church in D.C., a single mom, you know, she's finishing up her degree. She's probably finished by now, but at the time she was finishing up her degree, you know, raising her kid on her own. You know, the guy was gone from the scene. I think he was in jail, but gone from the scene. You know, so she's paying for daycare, she's paying for a class, she's working two or three jobs, and she says that when she goes to church and every Sunday they ask for tithes and offerings, and they push tithes and offerings, she feels bad because she doesn't have any money. And so she's like, you know, if there was some other alternative, if they could offer, you know, hey, come help out at the church, hey, you know, help come be a part of this group, something that would make her feel more human than the way she feels every Sunday doing offering, it will make a difference. And so we're hearing all kinds of stories like that, and I'm talking about that in the book. How do you take those stories, how do you take those realities, and then change them into something workable so that you can begin to make impact when it comes to really relating with these young adults? Yeah, because really it is bigger than hip-hop.
You know, and hence the name. So the woman's name is Bren Brown. She did a piece on YouTube that talks about vulnerability. A lot of us don't like to be in vulnerable positions. And when we're vulnerable, you know, we allow a lot of good things to happen as opposed to being prideful and hardwired to not want people to see that we're afraid, to know that we're broke, to know that we can't pay our PG&E payment. You know, we kind of doctor it up and present to the world this, you know, flashy dress, you know, a car that we're driving that we probably can't afford. You know, so for the most part, you know, when we selectively numb our emotions, We numb everything. We number that feeling of joy, that feeling of happiness, that feeling of knowing that we are good people in this world, you know. So like you said, the guy that had HIV or full-blown AIDS, the question is, are you gay? Well, there's still this stigma that being gay is tied to having AIDS when African-American women are the ones who are catching this disease the most. So, you know, when we're talking about being able to communicate to these young people, they're getting so many mixed messages in media,
Yeah. Even
in God dang on video games that they're playing. I looked at a video game that a kid was playing, and all you saw was people being murdered. Now, how good can that actually be for someone that is already predispositioned to go into a world that they're going to be facing these adversities? So, you know,
yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the Bible, okay? I've yet to read the entire Bible. Once I got past Genesis, I'm like, oh, my God. So the question I have, did you read the whole Bible, and what version of the Bible do you study?
Oh, those are two very good questions. I don't know that I have read the entire Bible. I don't think I have. I think I've read most of, I would probably say 80 to 90% of it. I don't know that I've read every single scripture in the entire Bible. I doubt I have. For example, I'm not really a fan of Revelation. So I don't really, you know, spend a lot of my time in that. Now, the Gospels, yes. Word for word, yes. The Gospels, yes. Paul's mm-hmm. writing, mostly. The Old Testament, yes. Word for word, Old Testament, yes. But Revelation, mm-hmm. I probably need to do some more work in that. I tend to go towards more lean towards the King James Version, only because
uh-huh.
there are so many other sources that help explain that. You know,
mm-hmm.
and so I can use the King James Version and then look up the words in the Greek or in the Hebrew a lot easier
mm-hmm.
than I could if I use, say, the Message Bible or the New Revised or something like that. And so for me, it's easier to find other sources to break down the text when I use King James versus using some other reference.
I hear you. So I want to talk about this. I hope I don't get struck by lightning for saying this, but blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus. So
uh-huh.
I know a lot of people have a problem with that. I certainly do. Yet this is the image that is perpetuated, you know, in every church you see, you know, and it really stirs controversy within me. But what are your thoughts about the imagery of this blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus?
Well, I think if you look historically, you'll see that even in the image of Jesus, there was some politics going on. I mean, certainly, I mean, we can both attest that if at the time that they created the image of Jesus as an image itself, they had put up a dark skinned brother with dreadlocks or cornrows, you know, history might have been wrote a little differently. So I think there was some politics working in that first paintbrush when it came to Jesus. Certainly, we know that Jesus was from a culture where it would have been impossible for him to be blonde hair, blue eyes. We know that's a rendition of somebody, but it is not Jesus. To me, if we're going to talk about Jesus, then I think was to me was relevant is the first discussion Jesus has, and I believe this is in Luke, the fifth chapter, the first, fifth or sixth, but the first discussion he has with John's disciples, because just as confused as we are about this blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus, they were equally confused about the real Jesus. And so they show up and they say, are you the one we've been waiting for, or should we look for another? Because they were looking for someone who was going to come on a white horse and, you know, save them from tyranny under Rome and do all this great stuff. And Jesus shows up healing, you know, people who are blind and those who are sick and walking on water and feeding 5,000. And they go, wait a minute, that ain't what we were looking for. You know, we were looking for a different kind of Jesus. And so Jesus tells John's disciples, well, go back and tell John what you see. Which you see that, the blind have sight. Those who are homeless now have a place to live. You know, those who have been convicted are now free from judgment. You know, those who are hungry have food. You know, so go back and tell them what you see. And so I think that if we're going to talk about the image of Jesus, what the church is really missing is the fact that are we really modeling who Jesus was? Are we really out there in the communities? Are we out there in the prisons? Are we out there, you know, where folk are really hurting? Or are we just building cathedrals and, you know, big mega churches and, you know, sitting back? So to me, the bigger disparity isn't in the pigmentation, it's in the application.
I like that. It's not in the pigmentation, but in the application. I got to write
in
that one down. You need to put that in one of your books. So now, Bigger Than Hip Hop is definitely a book for the ages. And how is it being received to the people that get it? I've seen pictures of people holding on to the book. So how well is it selling, and what has been your feedback about the book?
Well, listen, here's why I need your help. Here's why I need your favor, your input. I need you to let people know they can go to www.biggerthanhiphop.com and order a copy of the book. They can find it on Amazon, but it's easier to straight up biggerthanhiphop.com to get their copy of the book. Sales are going well. We're looking at doing a lot of conferences and workshops, and we're looking at as many opportunities as possible to be in as many churches and conferences to really talk about young adults. Again, it's my passion. It's actually my thesis for my dissertation. And so as many opportunities as possible that we can get in different places to talk about young adults, to expand your work, we're looking at. And again, they can go at any time to biggerthanhiphop.com to get their own copy. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And what I'd like you to do for me is definitely stay in touch with me. And if there's something that you want me to do here on the West Coast, actually, you know, promote the book, because I think that it's a blessing. It is a gift from God that he gave to you to go ahead and put out to the masses, because I dig the young people. I mean, I can't say I understand them all the time. You know, I turned on a Celebration of Gospel. And gospel music has taken such a turn. So I think it was the Clark Sisters that had that song Fall Down on me, and it was played a lot in the disco. So, you know, I know that, you know, there's this controversy as far as, like, where the music is right now. Me, I'm kind of like a traditional. I like, you know, meaningful music. I can't really get into the big orchestrated type of presentations that are happening now. But if it reaches somebody, then who am I to say, you know, stop doing it? If it's bringing people closer to the Word of God and to Jesus Christ, then who am I to say anything like that? But definitely make sure of all of my pages, I think I invited you on them, you can post freely. I know a lot of people in the industry now, and I'm saying that very humbly, but there are deals that happen without me even knowing it, that somebody has shown interest in a guest product, and they've actually connected. So this broadcast, feel free to, I'll send you the MP3 after the show, and you could post it anywhere you want to post it. But I'm just so grateful that you came here to this show today to enlighten us and work in the bridging of the gap between, you know, our elders and the newer generation. So who did design that website for you?
The website was designed by a company called Axe. Travis Smith Sr. is the one who runs that, man. But he's also the assistant pastor at our church. But he has a whole company that specializes in going into churches and helping them redo their technology of infrastructure. So he looks at websites, he looks at of how they communicate, you know, via Bible study or whatever, and helps design specific for each congregation of ways in which they can better utilize technology. And it's called Axe.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. And there's one other thing I'm hoping too, that somewhere in there, there's a teaching about financial direction, because you see so many people. I just saw that the actor Mekhi Phifer has filed for bankruptcy, but I know that Allen Iverson, Mike Tyson, the list goes on where people have, you know, don't know about how to manage money. So for the final question of the day, or the second to the final question of the day, because I want you to leave some wisdom here with the people today, but is there going to be some type of lessons learned about or taught about financial direction?
Yeah, in the book, in our chapter on support, we deal specifically with finances. One of the things I found was that, especially in our churches, what's happening, and I think you alluded to it earlier, as a hip-hop generational person, you know, we make purchases that may not adequately reflect our bank account. And
right.
So the car may look nice, but it may be negative $336 in the account. You know,
exactly.
So we're living off scraps, but driving something nice. And so the reality is that that most of our churches, our elders have done well. They're retired. They have managed money well. They have investments. They have all kinds of stuff. But they're sitting beside young adults who don't know anything about money or management.
Right.
But because we look good, they don't say anything to us. And so in my chapter on support, I talk about how do you break down that barrier between the exterior and really have some genuine conversation about management, specifically in terms of money, specifically in terms of couples. Because we have a lot of young adult couples now who are going through divorce and going through all kinds of major, you know, internal issues, and it all revolves around the mismanagement or ignorance of money. And I'm saying that the older generation has a great platform and opportunity to begin to have some dialogue with them if they're just willing to break down some barriers.
I think it's great. It sounds like the book has been very well thought out. It's something that people should have in their possession as a source of reference. It's one of the books that I can honestly see probably Oprah picking up one day as well. So I'm telling you right now, I just believe that this platform here on A Touch of Grace is reaching so many people right now that when they go back and listen to this, I'm sure that it's going to result in sales for your product, because I think it's definitely needed. So you are on A Touch of Grace. And the question I ask you, Robert Bell Jr., what is the best Blog Talk radio station on the air?
Oh, there is no other than Touch of Grace.
All right, that sounds fantastic. Okay, and so final thoughts. Thank you so much for that. What would you like to leave the listeners with today as the curtain closes down on today's show?
You know, in the book of John, 13th chapter, we often reference that at the Last Supper and not give our understanding of communion. And that's all good. Bread and wine is great. But what's more important than the bread and wine is something Jesus says right after that. What Jesus says right after that is, now that you've taken the bread and wine, I give you a new commandment, that you should love your neighbor. I think if you don't get nothing else, man, that the biggest thing you ought to get is that if you want to see real impact, whether it's with yourself, your family, your community, your circle of influence, whatever, then it all begins and ends with loving the other. And if we can just stay right there, everything else will just resolve and revolve itself. Yeah.
Amen. John 13. Well, you have been a phenomenal guest here on today's show, very enlightening, very empowering, most likely or most definitely very inspiring. So I'm going to go ahead and let you go on with your afternoon. I'll get that MP3 out to you. And thanks for doing the show today, Ronald. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you, man. Listen, love you. God bless your ministry. And Touch of Grace is awesome. Keep it up, brother. I'm praying for you.
I certainly will. Thanks a lot.
All right,
ladies and gentlemen, was that a cool hour or what? Now, that is a book that I definitely will have, because I've not been the best at my finances. And Ronald was actually right. You know, there are a lot of elders that got the money thing down packed. And so if we could teach our youth and even some of the ones who are not youthful like me anymore, the gift of money and how to actually use it, because most definitely this life is not about what you have or what you own. It's more about how you are inside and what you're putting out into the world. So I'll remember John 13, and hopefully you will too. So I'm going to talk to you about some upcoming shows. Tomorrow on the 10th, we have author Dryka Armstrong, who will join us to discuss her gift of literary prowess. I thank our mutual friend, for bringing us together, and I believe it was Nike Ma. And then on Sunday the 11th, there is no live broadcast because we celebrate Mother's Day, and I do love my mama very much. Love you, Mom. I know you're out there listening. Happy Mother's Day to the mothers from the past and the current, as well as the future. And then on Monday the 12th, R&B legends, the Delphonics. La, 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 la means I love you. They come to Street Player Presents On the Touch of Grace. So great guests, great shows, 40,000 strong. Special shout-outs to Yvette Brown over at Extravagant Entertainment, as well as my friends at World Media for bringing me so many talented guests to A Touch of Grace, but also to all of the support I receive on Facebook, as well as Stage 32. We've got some great guests coming up. And so I want to leave you with this final. When we get out from in front of ourselves, we can make magic happen. Our passion has a light so divine that it is profound. The higher power is always reaching out to us, encouraging us to be better. And we can be better. We must be better because we were created to be better. And know this without a doubt. GD loves you very much. Make sure you're loving yourself and those around you. And you're going to be all right, all right? You take care. I'll talk to you on Monday. Bye-bye.